The evidence of the eyewitness testimony within the Gospels is overwhelming. There is no doubt that the modern church in America has failed its people by not teaching them the earliest stages of church history. Apostolic succession paved the way to preserve the New Testament text.
Welcome to another episode of Facts. I am your host, Stephen Boyce. Today, I'm going to be looking at a subject that I recently just posted a blog on. That is the section of the deacon. What is the deacon? What is the deacon supposed to do? And one of the things that I mentioned in the blog very early on is that I've actually recently had to change my view of the deaconate. Because when we look at the diaconate, for example, we've seen different functions within the modern church. Sometimes they're nothing more but a glorified, I would say janitor, and I hate to be that way, but a glorified janitor. They're just in charge of the grounds, or they're in charge of, you know, just taking up some offering or counting money or cleaning or over the building and the grounds. And that's kind of how some people treat a deacon in today's world. And the reason for that is because there's been a pushback and a discouraging from the office that has been abused. And that is true. That's the other side of this. The other side is that some deacons have been treated as elders. They are in charge of the church. They're in charge of its spiritual direction. They're in charge of its financial direction. They're in charge of its physical direction. And as a result, they have served the role as an elder. And this is predominantly in the evangelical and Baptist churches, where deacons are typically the guys in charge. The pastor works for them. They have a meeting every week. They make decisions. This has typically been the case in those types of churches. And one of the things that I have seen, and I have pastored in those very two types of churches, and I am at fault for both, being a person who held one view and then switched to the other, but was never comfortable in either one of those views. To me, I was never satisfied with the position, because at some point in my life, I started to think, is the role of a deacon even necessary? Let's just get some legal trustees in there. And there were even times where we didn't have enough for deacons, so we did use trustees. And so that became something more interesting to me than actually the office itself. But man, was I missing the beauty and the majesty of the called role that we see both in the New Testament and the early writings of the church. And today I want to investigate mostly the writings of Ignatius of Antioch, because one, he has a lot to say about it, more so than anybody else. Irenaeus makes just a few statements about it. Justin Martyr makes a couple as well. We will look at one of his today, but Ignatius of Antioch uses quite a bit. The second reason I'm going to use Ignatius is because Tyler and I have been doing and are continuing through, and on the last episode next week, finishing a short series on Ignatius of Antioch's letters to the six churches, seven total letters, when he was on his way to be martyred in Rome. We just released over the weekend our newest one that covered the Church of Rome and the Church of Philadelphia, the two letters to those. If you have missed those, please go back, especially the one we just did. It was so important that we touched on certain aspects of the church, its function, unity, sectarianism. We got pretty hyped up in that one. It was a good episode. I enjoyed my conversation with Tyler. You can find that on the YouTube channel. You can also find that on the podcast. If you're listening through Facts, you can find that on there as well. Make sure you check that out. So it's also fresh in my mind. And while I was actually studying through this, I began to see things. I began to understand things in the writings of Ignatius that I actually called Tyler that day and said, hey, I have an idea about the deacon, and I'm getting it from Ignatius. I'm going to investigate this a little bit further. So I spent the next week investigating the subject of the diaconate in the early church, particularly through the first 100 years, the first 100 years of the writings of the patristics. And there I began to see Ignatius truly was the most profound when it came to this subject. And just kind of as a quick note of Ignatius, he's an important subject when we deal with this, because he was an apostolic bishop from the Church of Antioch, but he corresponded quite frequently with the Eastern churches, very close friends, it seems like, to Polycarp, which we'll get to that letter soon. And when we look at his pedigree, if you would, as a leader in the church. He was ordained under the succession line of Peter. He was second after Peter. Evodius was between them in Antioch. So Peter's being the leader of the church of Antioch. Evodius comes behind Peter after his martyrdom. Evodius, not much longer after him, comes Ignatius. We have from John Chrysostom these words. He said, he, Ignatius, obtained his office from those saints, and that the hands of the blessed apostles touched his sacred head. And it seems like that Peter could have been one of those apostles that was being referred to, but it also is very likely to be the apostle John. We see multiple statements in history where he is connected to the apostle John. We even have writings that are alleged to be from Ignatius written to Jesus's mother, Mary, and the apostle John. Now, those are considered spurious, and I would agree with that. I don't think they're legit, but the tradition itself is trying to pose and even replicate letters to these individuals because of his contact with them in his life. But we do have that attestation that he was connected to the apostle John. John Chrysostom said that he had the apostles lay hands on him for the office that he was in. Now, he seems to be very interested in the office of deacon. When describing the leadership roles in the church, he goes through the bishops. He goes through the elders, particularly. He calls the presbyters. And then he gets to the area of the diaconate. And within that, he actually says that they're one of his favorite groups. He says they are dear to me, most dear to me. And it's really no surprise when you're reading his letters. If any of you have read the letters of Ignatius, you'll see how important the deacons are to him. When writing to the Church of Philadelphia, particularly, he mentions two of them. He mentions Philo and Ruiz Agathopus. And he also mentions another one who was with him, who became what seemed to be his amanuensis writing the letter. It's hard to say, actually, because when we're looking at him, we're looking at it, there's some ambiguous statements in the Greek as to whether he was the deliverer of the letter or he was the one that actually wrote it. And his name was Boris and Burris. We really don't know for sure. I tend to the idea that he was the amanuensis. He was the scribe writing it, writing that letter for Ignatius. But what we do see is that in his travels while arrested, being taken to Rome, there are deacons from multiple churches. Philo is from Cilicia. We have deacons from Syria that are with him. We have deacons from Ephesus that are with him. And they're coming together and they're rallying behind Ignatius. They're working for him. They're writing letters. They're delivering letters. He sends some of the deacons ahead of him to Rome to prepare his arrival, to engage the church with what's about to go down and what to expect. This becomes instrumental as we go through these writings and we start looking at Ignatius this way. He is surrounded by the office of deacon every stop he makes in his travels to Rome to be executed. And so what we can learn from him is quite a bit because he gives them multiple shout outs and he actually talks about their work and what they do. In his statement to the Philadelphians, he actually encourages them to elect a deacon. And then send that deacon to his home church back in Antioch and encourage them in their time of trial and despair. Now, he stated that this deacon that they should elect would be an ambassador of God, not for another purpose within their own congregation, but to their sister church over in Antioch. So what we begin to see, right, right at the beginning of this, is the process of a deacon is that we elect them. He told them to elect a deacon to do this. Now, one thing that we should note, particularly about the election of deacons, is that we see this same thing take place in Acts chapter 6, verse 3. We do see the election of deacons. They called seven of them, and the people were to call them out. But another thing that needs to be noted with that is that that was not the end of the story. There was also apostles laying their hands on them in verse 6 and ordaining them to the office. So just because the congregants choose a deacon to be in their midst, that does not mean that settles the matter. There has to be, really in this case, apostolic approval in Acts, and then in the case of Ignatius, bishopric and presbyter approval and ordination on hand. So it's not just that the people elect somebody, it's they elect them and then they ordain by the bishops or the presbyter that are in the location of the church. And this person is being represented as an ambassador of God. That's our first hint as to what a functioning deacon looked like in the early church. They were representatives, not necessarily of their church, although they are, because Ignatius even says he serves you well, or he represents you well, or that he serves your cause in the right way, in a manner worthy of Christ. He'll say things like that in his letters. But most importantly, a deacon is bigger than his local congregation. Oh, he represents them, but he represents God first and foremost, and he is a servant. Diakonos in Greek is servant. He is a servant of God himself in God's churches that is stationed in a single church. And we're going to see this unfold in the ministry. We see that they become mediators between leaders and churches. And I'm not talking about the leaders of the church they belong to. I'm talking about leaders of other congregations. We see a deacon, as I mentioned earlier, named Burrus in his writings. And he has mentioned that he was there with him, beside him, in corresponding letters, either again by written or by delivery, or both. I mean, it's possible it's both. However, when we look at Burrus as a person, we have to go back to Ignatius's letter to the Ephesians, where he states that he was one of the four delegates of the Ephesian church that sent him to Ignatius to help him. He says this: "Now about my fellow servant Burrus, or slave Burrus, your godly deacon, who has been richly blessed. I very much want him to stay with me. He will thus bring honor to you and the bishop." So what he's saying is Burrus has been such a great aid to him that he wants him to remain in his travels, not just blessing him, but also bringing honor to their church and to the bishop. Well, why is that the case? Because what he's doing in this is he is mediating between the sending church, the other churches that are concerned about Ignatius, and Ignatius himself. So much so that he's either writing for Ignatius or he's delivering these messages for him. But he is being a mediator for the bishop. He is following in the place of the bishop in his travels, and he is updating the churches. He is corresponding between these churches. And what we have to acknowledge right from that standing is that when we look at the deacon, it does not function well in autonomy. The idea of the autonomous church has been pushed long enough. We are autonomous. We're self-governing. Listen, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with having self-governing churches. In a sense, there's nothing wrong with actually having ourselves in the midst of a place where they are serving their church and their leaders, and that things are happening within the church in a nice, succinct way, and there's organization, there's budgeting. I'm not saying any of the things are wrong in any way, shape, or form. But there is no evidence in the New Testament scriptures or in the early patristic writings that the churches were functioning as independent churches apart from each other. No, they were cooperating together in light of the same vision. And there were multiple churches under one bishop whose bishops were a part of one ecumenical leadership council and gathering, where they were working together as all being common in the sense of their apostolic succession, aiding and leading and guiding and teaching the churches the doctrines of the faith that were once delivered to them as saints and delivering it to the next generation of saints. That is what's taking place here. And for a deacon to be at his fullest, there has to be churches cooperating together in order to see the true function of the office, because the earliest deacons go beyond their doors to aid and work with other leaders in congregations that are partnering together in the gospel. And we have no greater evidence of this than in the writings of Ignatius, and we have no greater example of this than Burris from Ephesus. And the godliness that he displayed, including the words, "your godly deacon," blessing the leadership on behalf of his sending church, honoring not only it, but its bishop in the city of Ephesus. So there's a connection here. There's a connection between deacon and two bishops. So he has the bishop of Ephesus, you have the bishop of Antioch. He leaves the church in Ephesus as a delegate, as an ambassador, to go and aid in any need Ignatius has. And he begins the process of correspondence and doing a lot of the groundwork by serving the bishop of Antioch, though being a deacon from Ephesus. We don't see this autonomy. We see shared vision, shared work, shared gospel, shared church. They are one holy and apostolic church. They're one holy Catholic and apostolic church. They are a universal church of believers under the banner of no one but Christ, operating under its leaders, ordained by Christ's apostles. That's what's happening in this section. And then later on, we see also in his letter to the Magnesians, he writes about another deacon named Zosian. He says, "I am delighted with him because he submits to the bishop as to God's grace and the presbytery of the law of Jesus Christ." Now notice how Zosian is responsible in the words he just mentioned to the bishop and the presbytery. Zosian proved himself to be a reliable servant of Christ by serving the congregation who elected him, by serving the ordained leaders and the ordained leaders of the partnering churches. Same thing we see with Burris. So then what do we look at here? So we see that they're elected and then ordained. We see that they kind of serve as mediators to the whole church. They're ambassadors, representatives of God in all the churches of Jesus Christ, to aid in all of the leadership that is trying to work together for the same cause of Jesus. But we also see that they were in the business of edification. Deacons were a part of the ministry of edification. When writing to the Trallians, Ignatius tells the church that deacons were servants of Christ's mysteries. Now, there's no doubt in my mind he was referring to 1 Corinthians 4:1 there when he said that. They were to nourish people with the knowledge of the truth of the gospel. This is evident by following this following statement: must give complete satisfaction to everyone. This is what Ignatius is saying to the Trallians, that the deacon must give complete satisfaction to everyone. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean, well, his job is to go around and make everybody happy? No, that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is anybody who comes in contact with the deacon should be refreshed, edified, built up, educated, made clear rather than confused as it relates to who Jesus is, as it relates to the church, its function, its progress. These are things that are taking place in the early church. They were known as people to really exercise edification. These are the kind of people you want to be around. These are the kind of people when you're going through a bad situation, you want to call up. These are the people that when you're going through the bad situation, you want praying over you. No wonder why Ignatius, who's about to be martyred, says that he is fond and loves and adores the deacons, because they were there for him in his greatest moments of despair. They lifted his spirits when he was down. They gave him hope and encouraged him of biblical truth when the fear was probably crippling him as to what may come. This is the office of a deacon. They ought to be not the bullies of the church, but those that build up the church. And I think that this has become a dangerous thing in the modern church era, is that the deacons are known as the fake, those that put on a show, those that serve themselves, those that are seeking power, when actually it's the opposite. The deacon was actually seeking to exalt those who are already given the gifts of leadership and the gifts of authority. They were there to actually aid and build up in credibility the authority of the leader. They were there to refresh and to educate. They're there to actually exalt Christ by exalting his offices of the church. They should never have been the group that does the secret meetings, that dictates the direction of a church. There is not a single scriptural passage where the deacons are serving in the position of elders. They aid the elders. They equip and build up and refresh the elders. The deacons are the people who you should want to be around, because when you're in the same room with them, you walk away encouraged and edified and educated. And they're the type of people that you would want to send to the neighboring churches when they need someone's help from your church, because you trust them and they have a reputation that honors Christ and honors the scope and the direction of your own church. So they were seen as being a part of edification. Ignatius also tells us another function of the deacon and how they built up their own congregations. He states in his letter to the Trallians, "For they do not serve mere food and drink, but minister to God's church. They must therefore avoid leaving themselves open to criticism as they would shun fire." Now, what is he saying here? What he's saying is the idea of food and drink is more than likely, and I don't think anybody would dispute this, the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist. Remember, the Eucharist was not just bread and wine at many of these functions in the early church. They had what they called love feasts, where deacons were actually serving the full meal. They were the waiters, if you would, at that point. But it's interesting how they handled this in its distribution. This is seen also in the writings of Justin Martyr. He states, "When the president has given thanks," which is probably the presbyter, "and all the people have expressed their assent, those who are called by us deacons give to each of those present to partake of the bread and the wine mixed with water, over which the Eucharist or thanksgiving and praise are pronounced. And to those who are absent, they carry away a portion." Now note that is so important what Justin Martyr tells us just a few years after Ignatius. These leaders, the deacons, within their church seem to help aid the presbyter in the Eucharist table every week. And yes, it was every week. They took at the gathering, and by the way, let me just back up there. Ignatius talks about how important it is to continue to offer the Eucharist, that the meeting at the table should happen the more often because it disembodies the work of Satan. It dismantles his strength, his power. It dismantles sectarianism. It dismantles disunity. And so that being so important actually helps us understand why this next section of Justin Martyr is true. If it is just mere symbolism that has no spiritual effect, no benefit to anybody, why in the world would the deacons be obligated to take the Eucharist table that was served in the gathering and run into the town and go find its congregants that could not make it due to sickness, that could not make it due to being under slave labor in their county or in their country or in their respected city that they owed debt to and they had to work it off and couldn't be in the gathering, or somebody who is dysfunctional? Why is it that they would take the same loaf of bread that was served in the gathering and take what was from it and its cup of wine, go out into the city and find those that were not there in the congregation and make sure they receive the Eucharist as well? Well, because it has more than just symbolic feelings and nature to it, and it's more than memorialism. It clearly was a means of grace, and it was clearly the spiritual food of the church, and even those that could not make it were not going to be left absent from its portion. And therefore, the deacons served the Eucharist table for the presbytery. Once again, that's a way of building up the church. That's a way of giving grace and comfort to the church, is by making sure everyone, including those that are not there, are able to take of the Lord's Supper. And that is a huge, huge lesson that we can learn from not only the power of the Eucharist, but also the distribution of it from the actual deacons themselves. So, yes, we see them serving communion. We see them at the gathering meeting to those that are absent. And this could have included, again, multiple things: sickness, serving elsewhere, restriction, forced labor. So remember, Ignatius said that they were ministers of God's church. Notice he didn't say the Church of Philadelphia or the Church of the Trallians or the Church of Ephesus or the Church of Rome. It's God's church, the whole church. They were instrumental in getting it to the entirety of God's church. The deacons were the glue that held the early churches together. And this was by serving the Eucharist to those near and far, serving the presbyters and the bishops from varying churches, writing letters of correspondence, delivering letters of correspondence, and serving as forerunners to ordained leaders. Folks, this is what they were. The deacons were the John the Baptist to Jesus of Nazareth. That's what they were. They were preparing the way of the leaders of the church. And that's the next section. So we see the deacons, they are mediators. They are involved in the ministry of edification and building up. They serve the supper of the Lord for those that are at the congregation and those that couldn't make it to the congregation. But they are also preparing the way of a ministry. They were forerunners to the leaders of God's church. Consider the biblical text in light of these words of Ignatius and Justin. In Acts 6, once the deacons were selected to serve tables, Stephen was seen reasoning with men from the synagogue of the freedmen. Now, the freedmen were likely Jews who had been taken captive to Rome by Pompey and were later made free in their return to Jerusalem. Now, they seem to have formed their own synagogue in the area of Jerusalem to worship. And the writer of Acts, Luke, is instructing us that there were different types of backgrounds that were part of this synagogue, like Alexandrians, Cyrenians, and Cilicians, and the Asians. And so Stephen was preparing the way for the apostles' ministry to outsiders. While they're still equipping the church there, Stephen immediately in Acts chapter number 6, goes off to the outsiders, starts working towards those that are from other nations like Alexandria and Cilicia and Asia Minor. And he starts ministering to them. Now, to the end of this story, he obviously got stoned and became the first martyr of the church, but it was his attempt to go after new converts and to evangelize even those outside of Israel. Now, this is also true in the next couple of chapters. In Acts chapter number 8, we see another deacon, Philip, preaching the gospel north in Samaria. He was acting as a forerunner to the apostles' ministry to the Samaritans before the apostles even arrived. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, the text tells us that many believed and were baptized, but had not yet received the Spirit. And once the road was paved by Philip, by bringing in a group of people who were hearing the truth, believing in the truth, and being baptized in it, the Church of Jerusalem then sends Peter and John to Samaria to lay hands on the believers to receive the Spirit. But it's a deacon that's preparing the way. And this doesn't just happen for converts of evangelizing. So what we see here is that the deacons are actually educated in the scriptures. Stephen was able to reason with the best of them in the synagogues. So a deacon needs to be equipped in the scriptures. He needs to be able to defend the scriptures. He is an apologist and an evangelist. He is an apologist in his predecessor, Stephen. He's an evangelist in his go-gettedness, if you would, and I just made that up, by Philip. Philip is the one that's going after the outcast, the Samaritans, but he prepares the way. And once the way is prepared, then comes Peter and John to lay hands and begin to give gifts of the Spirit by the power of the Spirit in them and the authority of Christ that he gave them. They are preparing the way for ministry. But they also prepared the way, not just to unbelievers, but to the church. Similar thing happens in the ministry of Paul. We see a deaconess, and yes, there were deaconesses in the early church. We see it in Romans chapter 16, verse 1 and 2. We also see very early evidence of it. No, they were not. Again, if you think that a deacon is an elder and you treat them as the service of an elder, then I understand your trip up with the idea of women deaconesses. But even the early patristics tell us that there were deaconesses in the church, and many of them helped serve during sickness and baptisms of women so that the elders would never and the bishops would never be in a position of compromise while baptizing women or being around women that are sick by ended up seeing them naked or things like that. So there was protection in place. But there were women deaconesses, but they were never authorities in the church. They were servants. They were preparing the way. They were giving out work and edification just like these others. And we see one named Phoebe in Romans 16. When writing to the Romans before his arrival, he sends Phoebe from the church from an eastern port in the city of Corinth. Not Rome. She's not from Rome. She's from Corinth. But sends her to Rome to prepare his path and arrival. He seeks to arrive at Rome. He wants to get to the Romans, but at this point he cannot. So he sends someone ahead of him. And he instructs the church to welcome her in a manner that is worthy of the saints. And Ignatius did the same thing to the church of Rome years later after Paul. He says to the church in Rome, indeed, even those that did not naturally lie on my route went ahead, catch it, to prepare my welcome in the different towns. And these would be the deacons that he sent. So we see Paul and Ignatius both writing to the Romans within a 60-year span of each other, are sitting here telling them that I'm sending somebody ahead of me to prepare my arrival. This is somebody getting the churches ready, giving instruction, making sure they have a place to stay, making sure their ministry is going to be able to have opportunities, making sure the people are ready, bringing any kind of letters that needed to be sent to them. That's what the deacons were doing here. They're preparing the way. And when we talk about this, we find that they are working very closely to the churches and to its leaders with the expectation of setting up the stage, not for themselves, but for somebody that's coming. They are the John the Baptist of the Jesus of Nazareth. They are serving, and he must increase, I must decrease mentality. The bishop is coming. I need to prepare the way. I need to get things ready for him. There needs to be arrival instructions. And they are working to build the ministry of the leader. And that's what the deacons were doing for the apostles, like Philip to John and Peter. That's what Phoebe was doing for Paul. That's what these deacons were doing for Ignatius. That's what needs to be done in our church. They need to model themselves in this way. And we know this continued in the time of Ignatius, that the servitude was going on. We have a letter from Pliny the Younger writing to Emperor Trajan, trying to figure out what Christianity was all about. And when explaining to Trajan the operations of the church in Bithynia, he writes these words, "I then thought it the more needful to get at the facts behind their statements. Therefore, I placed two women called deaconesses under torture. But I found only a debased superstition carried to great lengths. So I postponed my examination and immediately consulted you." Now, one might ask the question, why did Pliny capture two women called deaconesses to investigate Christian gatherings? Here's what I think happened. I think that two women were serving the tables of Eucharist with aiding the presbyters, and they were about to go out into the town, like Justin Martyr had told us they did, and go serve others. And in the process of them taking the Eucharist to probably some sick or those that couldn't make it, they were captured by Pliny. And Pliny tortured them. He said he tortured them and found that they were superstitious. And he gets all this information about what they're really about. So he's writing to Trajan. Remember, they're under suspicion of Christianity. They're meeting in secrecy. They're not just letting anybody in. They thought they were conspirators, and they were concerned about conspiracy. So what they did is they brought them in under investigation. Turns out these women were, in his mind, just carrying on about a bunch of debased superstition that was carried out to its fullest discretion. I mean, this is what he had an idea of and said, all right, I stopped my examination and consulted you as to what I should do next. But it was probably women serving and preparing the way for Eucharist and possibly for the presbyters and leaders to come later and pray over those people that couldn't be at the gatherings by serving them Eucharist ahead of time. That's what I think is happening. So how do we conclude this? How do we wrap this up? Let's review and summarize what the deacon is. The office of deacon was made up of individuals that were elected by the congregations to serve the Eucharist table to those near and those that are abroad, meaning those that were in the congregation and made it to the congregation that day and those that could not for whatever reason. They were ambassadors of God to the churches by serving its bishops and elders. This consisted of writing letters of correspondence for them, delivering letters of correspondence for them. They were also assigned to remain in traveling with leaders in the church, like the bishops, serving the ministry on behalf of their sending church. They were there to be an aid to not just their own leaders, but leaders of partnering churches. Often this looked like being a forerunner to their ministry by going ahead of the bishop or apostles when they were alive to prepare the arrival of their leaders. So what does all that mean to us today? Given this is a sensitive subject and people struggle with this subject, let me apply this to the church in our modern era. My first response after studying this, folks, and getting into the depths of understanding now the scriptural narrative and the historical narrative and seeing their consistency together, because let's be real, the diaconate in the New Testament is quite ambiguous, and it seems kind of sporadic. One minute they're serving tables, and bam, they're starting churches in Samaria and getting stoned for challenging some of the most well-thought-out religious leaders in synagogues. It's kind of like, wait, what? And then you don't really see much about them anymore. They're addressed in Paul's letter to the Philippians, the deacons and the bishops. But have you ever stopped and wondered why he addressed the deacons and the bishops? Because the deacons were serving the bishops of the church spread out throughout the Philippian area. I mean, that's what's going on here. So when we look at them together in the office of deacon, it is kind of ambiguous in the New Testament. But then when we actually understand what Justin Martyr is saying, we see a little bit of Pliny, who hated Christianity but was interested in him, and what he says to Trajan. And then we look at the fullness of Ignatius's letters here. We start building something that makes sense, something that works. And my first response to those that are listening is, what we need to start with is we need to repent at wrong views of the deacon. We need to recover the ancient office of deacon and put aside all modern nuances. Let me just say this in admission. I had to repent of my positions. The position of looking them as nothing more but a glorified janitor, and also looking them as the functioning elders of the church. Neither is accurate or biblical to the biblical or historical texts. The deacons are ambassadors for their church, who should be trained in the scriptures, capable of evangelizing with the gospel, capable of defending its truths, in areas of the community that are unreached. This could look like serving the community in physical or its physical and spiritual needs, one or the other, both, with the love and the message of the gospel. They should be looking to facilitate the gospel in areas of their community, areas of their other churches, areas in their own church. They should be forerunners, seeking opportunities to evangelize in their community, seeking for the opportunity to create disciples, seeking opportunities by serving the physical and spiritual needs of their community. That's not hard to do. Folks, it doesn't take much to go out into our community and see its needs all over the streets. The deacons need to be setting the framework to go into these communities to bring the gospel influence with them, so that they can set the stage and be forerunners by bringing the gospel into an area and serving the physical needs of the church and serving the physical needs of the community, and then bringing out the gospel message and influencing that unevangelized group with it, paving the way for the church leaders to come behind and actually finish the work of Christ in that, and then bring those people into the faith-based community, to those who come to Jesus. I don't know many deacons doing that. Now, I'm sure there's some out there, and I hope there is. But we need more. We need less deacons sitting in Thursday night, once a week meetings, every single week or every other week of the month, making decisions they are not called to make, making decisions they're not ordained to make because they're not elders. They also don't need to be sitting around serving the church as a janitor, cleaning the church, and doing all these extra things. I'm not saying they can't do those things. I'm saying that's not their call. If they choose to do that, then God bless them. But they're not the janitors of the church, and they're not the elders of the church, but they are the forerunners of the church. They are forerunners of the leaders of their church to go out and to plant seeds of the gospel in their community by serving their community and paving a way for their church to go into that community and influence it the more. They are also servants of church leaders, their church and the church of their partnering churches, the leaders of their partnering churches. They are tasked with facilitating the ministry of their local congregation with other congregations' spiritual needs. They don't just serve their church and their leaders. The deacons should be seeking relationships with their neighboring churches, building community with them, and setting up opportunities for their leaders to work together and making their job easier to do it. Tell you what, that ain't happening because everybody wants a secretary to do that. You don't need a secretary to do spiritual work. You have deacons that can go and facilitate these things. And most importantly, everywhere the deacon goes, they should represent the ministry of Christ by breathing new life into its realm of influence. This is not easy, but this is the true calling of a deacon. And this is what it looks like to recover the ancient office of deacon. And I hope and pray that we stop defending the things that don't need to be, just let it go. We've been wrong about this in the big E evangelical churches. We've been wrong about this for quite a while. Very few churches use the office of deacon properly. Anybody and everybody can be a deacon now. And unfortunately, it's ironic. We have a college mascot called the Demon Deacons in Wake Forest, which is ironic because that's how the world looks at most deacons in church. Oh, I'm a deacon in my church. My grandfather's a deacon in the church. So what? So you're probably unqualified. Your grandfather is probably unqualified. You're probably functioning in a situation that's not actually a true office of a deacon. And you're using that over people's head as if you're something super special and you hold a position of authority that makes you significant and important. And now that you feel important, you've all of a sudden given yourself a pat on the back. That's not what a deacon does. It's not what a deacon does. A deacon is there to build up, not pat himself on the back. A deacon is there to pave the way and be the forerunner for the gospel to go into areas that have not been evangelized yet in his community and in neighboring churches, his communities, and working together with leaders in its church and other churches to facilitate opportunities of unity amongst the churches locationally and across the world to get the gospel to the people that need it, and to start and plant new works of Christ and new churches that follow in its path. That is what the deacons were doing in the early church, and that is what we need to be doing in the modern church. And I trust and pray that in time, we would study this and see this for ourselves, and so that the gospel can be advanced. It's not a small thing. This isn't a silly thing. This is a big deal. And I think it's time to align ourselves both with the biblical teaching and the historical teaching on this subject. Well, like always, thanks again for tuning into this episode. Keep your eyes open for more. And again, if you missed those that were already giving to us that we talked about on Ignatius, you can go back and watch those too and listen to those too. Third one will be coming out next week. Tomorrow we have another program talking about Sola Scriptura and Prima Scriptura. Tomorrow night, check into the YouTube channel. That'll be available to you. I will be on there both with Pat May, Jonathan Sheffield, and Samuel Neeson. It'll be duly given to us. It'll be duly given out on two YouTube channels. It'll be on Explore Christianity's and Explain International's YouTube channel. Once again, thanks again for your support and your love for this ministry. Grace and peace to you. God bless.